Welcome to the Relaunch Podcast. And on today's show, buckle up, because this is the type of show that I just get goosebumps from my head to my toes, which means you know it's going to be good. You know it. And I have to say, when I first talked to this incredible woman and she was telling me her relaunch story and all about her, I was just like, my chin hit the floor. I'm like, you are absolutely, I felt like, you know, it was American Idol and you're on, you got the golden ticket, go. So super, super excited to introduce you to Lynn Walker. She's worked for several years with at-risk high school students whose parents were drug addicts and alcoholics. And she is the author of Midnight Calling, a memoir of a drug smuggler's daughter. The sequel, A Perfectly Good Fantasy, a memoir and Breaking Midnight, which is a true story. And I have to tell you, if you are out on your run, a walk, sitting there just driving, you are in for such a treat.
You're listening to the Relaunch Podcast with your host, Hillary DeCesar, best-selling author, TV host, speaker, and 23 years as a neuro-business performance coach. She will merge modern personal development, up-to-date neuroscience, and ancient wisdom with a twist, while using her one and only 3HQ method. Get ready to be empowered in your journey of self-reinvention and ignite your professional dreams. Each episode unfolds inspiring stories of remarkable relaunches, revealing the tips and secrets behind them. Join us in these conversations, offering you the insights and tools needed for your own extraordinary relaunch.
Lynn, I am so excited to have you on the show and to literally have people get to know you and have them go and read your book. So thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Hillary. It's so thrilling to be here. It's good to connect with you over the last month, and I'm so excited to talk to you today.
Oh, are you kidding? This is, you know, people hear stories like you're about to tell us, and they're usually in movies. They have a big named person, you know, wanting to play the role. And here, this is your life. But I want to go back and start with, I always like to go there, with your biggest relaunch that has impacted you the most and has brought you to where we are today. And so let's start there.
Okay. That would be my Mount Everest.
Let's start on Mount Everest.
My Mount Everest would definitely be rebuilding my life after my recovery from drug and alcohol addiction. I mean, it's just such a monumental thing to do. And so many people battle with addiction of different kinds, but drug and alcohol addiction was definitely my Mount Everest.
Well, and here's the thing. You actually built your life from, you know, you had the addict, the incarcerated youths. I mean, you had all these different things, right?
Right.
Can you share with us, how did this all come to be? Like, what was the impetus that made you first start? How young were you? Like, let us know a little bit more, because then it tees up what you've been doing and
Right. Sure.
Really understand everyone exactly what I'm referring to.
Okay. So I always like to start with my very idyllic childhood, because I had this great childhood in this blue collar suburb of Miami. And I, you know, had a stay at home mom, because that's what many moms did in the 70s, although she did have a nursing degree. And my dad was a highly successful undercover narcotics agent for what was then called the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs. It's now the DEA. And, you know, we just traipsed around that southern Miami suburb, and we didn't cross, you know, Dixie Boulevard or Caribbean Boulevard, and we were free to roam. And then when I was 8, my dad snuck out of our house literally in the dark of night and left a note in the mailbox for my mom. I can see it today, yellow legal paper in the mailbox. And that just really got my world to wobble. And my dad and I were very close, very connected, as I am and was and am with my mom. But his walking out on us just really set my world upside down. And I didn't really come to find out whatever happened to him until I was in high school. And he got arrested and went to prison for smuggling 12,000 pounds of marijuana. And I live in a state where marijuana is legal, but 12,000 pounds is never legal. It's a plane full. It was a Convair 440 airplane and two cargo trucks. And the thing is by then I had already followed in my brother's footsteps, not saying that divorce is the cause of addiction, but he struggled mightily with that divorce. My dad and mom eventually divorced and he was using drugs and alcohol. And I sort of followed in those footsteps of my older brother. By the time I found out my dad was going to prison, I already had a pretty bad drug and alcohol habit. You know, I think that I probably had the propensity for addiction. I think it's hereditary. I come quite naturally. I mean, my father is clearly an addict. And I think, too, I was just trying to find this.
But what's interesting is that your dad was actually on the other side as a cop, right?
Yeah.
And so was your mom shocked? Did she have any indication that this was happening? I mean, leaving a note and just leaving, disappearing?
We had no idea. I mean, he was a very religious man. His dad was a minister. We grew up in this very religious family. He taught my Sunday school class for years. He was in the choir at church. He was a, you know, ex-Marine and a very dedicated police officer. She had no idea. She knew something was wrong, though, because he definitely changed after that. He remarried right away, started another family, but he was never the same. There were all these big wads of cash, and he was always trying to buy me jewelry, and something was not right. And I remember feeling like something really bad is going to happen. As a young girl, I started to have that feeling.
Yeah, that premonition that something was going down.
Especially when you're so connected, right? Because I was so connected to him that I think I just had that sense that something really bad was going to happen. And of course it did. And so once we knew, I mean, in retrospect, my mom said, oh, this makes perfect sense, right? And I, as a teen who was already in serious trouble with drugs and alcohol, and, you know, by this time I'm getting arrested for breaking and entering. I was a runaway. You know, by the time I was 15, I was a ward of the juvenile court, you know, as a direct reaction to my drug and alcohol abuse. So I already had this trouble. So you would think many kids might see what their dad's doing and think, oh, well, maybe I should turn my life around here because dad's in prison. But I felt connected to him. I felt like for the first time in years, oh, I turned out just like my dad. It was like this sense of a bond I had with him, which was a horrible setup for when he did get out of prison. And he got out literally the month of my high school graduation. And he came up for my high school graduation. We were in Ohio by then. He was down in the federal pen in Florida. And I knew right away he did not get reformed in prison. I could tell right away, right? And he was wired. And this was mid-80s. So by now it's cocaine cowboy days in Florida. So he met this huge connection in the federal prison in Florida, this Colombian drug lord who was running his family's operation from the pen. It was a low minimum security prison. His brothers would fly in from Colombia. They'd meet. He was helping them run this operation. And so he had this connection to this man back in prison, and this guy set him up. And so on parole, my dad started smuggling again, this time all cocaine. And so within a few months of him reconnecting with me and my brother, we were, you know, in a very unhealthy situation where dad was giving cocaine to my brother who is dealing for him. And I was, you know, using a lot of cocaine with my father. Not that that's ever okay. Like, that's a pretty bad thing to do. But I just have to say, we were not innocent children. We were fully into drug and alcohol abuse by this time. But we willingly, you know, accepted that. I mean, it was uncut Colombian cocaine. I mean, it was flying in straight from the production in the jungles and probably, and, you know, a lot of it was produced in Peru and other countries. But
did you actually work for your dad?
You know, I never did. I never did any dealing like that. My brother did, and I just stayed really close to my brother and my dad and got free cocaine, which I thought was going to be a wonderful thing. But when you're a drug addict, it's a horrible thing, you know, to have this unlimited access.
So we're going to go into more detail around your dad, around the book, around the stories that you've written. But how did you pull yourself out of that? I mean, I'm looking at you right now, this incredible, beautiful, beautiful soul inside and out. And, you know, that's heavy duty. That is a big leap to go from where you were to where you are now.
Yeah. Well, the thing is that it really, as I said, I was already abusing alcohol and drugs and all that comes with that. I mean, addiction takes people to some pretty dark places, particularly women, I think. But the thing with that is I thought it was going to keep me out of trouble, right? Because it was dad's stuff and my brother's stuff. But really what it did is it just brought me to my knees because I had this unlimited source of drugs that I didn't have to pay for or do other things for that some women do. So I lost pretty much everything. I mean, I got booted out. I was trying to go to college. That didn't last long. I was on academic probation. They booted me out. I pretty much couldn't, you know, I had no friendships with women. I didn't know how to have friendships with women. And I was trying to save for men because they always got me in trouble. You know, I was pretty isolated and I just really feel like I lost everything and everyone I cared about. I mean, my mom knew that I had been struggling. She knew. She'd been trying to intervene for years, but I was living on my own. And I just had a horrible night where I was sitting on, right, which means watching my half kilo of cocaine, which is about a pound. It's a lot. For my brother, because he was so paranoid. He thought the police were watching his house. And I thought, oh, sure, I'll sit on it. So he brings over this, you know, kilo, half kilo. He didn't say I couldn't use it, right? So I then, after 3 days, have been using this stuff nonstop, haven't slept. I am maintaining a job. Get this, Hillary, at a psychiatric hospital, right? I'm the mail clerk and the switchboard operator at the psychiatric hospital. You know,
no way.
I'm out of sick leave, you know, and I am in such bad shape after 3 days of using. I'm hiding, you know, in the house. And it was kind of this is really a turning point for me. It was like about 4 or 5 a.m. when the robins start chirping, you know, and it's a beautiful time in the morning if you're in good, healthy condition. But when you've been up for days, it's a horrific feeling. And I was supposed to go to work and I was afraid I was going to lose that job. And I just peeked out my window. And there was a cop car sitting behind the apartment backed up to this gas station. And I freaked because I thought, well, maybe they are watching my brother. And, you know, we all have the same last name, my dad, my brother, and my dad's on parole, right? So I go and hide this stuff in the attic and I go take a shower and try to kind of straighten up a little. And the cop car is still out there and I am just pacing. And I think I'm going to call my dad. He'll tell me what to do, right? He's my dad. He loves me. And I tell him in kind of vague terms, in case my phone's tapped, what's going on. And he says, well, darling, I don't know nothing about this. And it was just like that, snap, the windows open to my, I realized I am in a seriously dangerous situation. I have a half kilo of cocaine in my attic, a cop car out front. My dad's on parole. He's not going to take a fall for me. He'd go back to prison under the RICO Act for probably 20 years. He's not going back to prison. And my brother's not going to waltz into the police station and say, oh, that's my stuff, you know? And it just, boom. It just like that. It just, I got scared straight there and I realized what is going on. And I just called this old drug counselor and said, I'm in a bad place. And for the first time in years, I got honest with somebody and he said, oh, you're in trouble there. You know, you flush that stuff. I said, I can't flush it. And he said, well, then you must not be ready to get clean. And I said, no, you don't understand. It's too much. I can't flush. He said, well, call your brother and tell him to come get it or you're going to flush it and he'll be over. of course, he showed up with his scales within 15 minutes, you know, to see how much I had been sorting. But, you know, he took his stuff back and I that was the turning point for me. Like
what happened? What, first off, did the cop ever ring your door?
You know, never. The cop never. By the time my brother came, so this is probably an hour later, the cop was gone. So the cop, maybe they were just back there having morning coffee. I don't know. I'll never know to this day. They never knocked on my door. And my brother never got arrested either. So, yeah.
So you hit rock bottom when you realize that you're alone in this thing, trying to figure out, you know, how you're going to handle the big amount of coke that you have. You're trying to figure out how to make the situation go away. Your brother comes over, and how do you start down the path? You start to go to therapy. You start to talk to this guy or woman, I don't know. Yep. And what happened?
Yeah, the first thing he said is, meet me at a 12-step meeting. I thought, oh, no, because I'd been to those when I was a ward of the court, right? The court made me go, and I didn't understand anything about that. I thought that was religion. I didn't want that. But that's what he said to do. And it was a male therapist. And I said, oh, really? Is that my only? He said, well, you must not be ready. Okay, I'll go. So I did, you know. So for once I get honest with somebody, and for once I do what I say, right? And I do show up at that meeting, and he immediately introduces me to some women. I was like, oh, first 12-step meeting and now women, right? So
you're really getting hit with everything. You did say something really interesting, that in your belief system, you think women have it harder in addiction?
Well, I mean, that's very generalized. I mean, I'm sure there are many men that are victimized too, but women are just, I feel like they're just vulnerable. And I think that the things that come with abusing drugs and alcohol, you know, a lot of our morals sort of slip away, and we behave in ways that we may not want to, or maybe wouldn't normally. And it often revolves around men, you know? I mean, not to be too crass, but the saying is, you get drunk and your clothes fall off, you know? And it just makes you very vulnerable.
Yeah.
And you're not in your right mind, right? And sometimes you're not even conscious. You're blacked out or unconscious. So it's just, it's not.
How long did it take you to get healthy? Did you ever have a relapse?
Yeah, I did. It didn't stick right away. Even then, I sort of came in and out, and I started therapy. I really am a big believer in therapy, by the way. I think anybody can benefit from therapy if it's a good therapist. I started that, and I would come in and out of those 12-step meetings. I did stay away from my dad and my brother. That's the one thing I did do. But I finally did, you know, several months later, finally start to, finally take advice from other people, and maybe had enough, a shred of self-esteem to be able to stop, to put down the alcohol and the drugs. And I did get, I think I had about a little over 5 years. And I did, I mean, I really, life got really good. You know, if you're a drug addict or an alcoholic and you stop, you put that stuff down and work some kind of, you know, I think whatever works for you, some kind of spiritual program or something, life gets good, and life got really good.
So then what inspired you to actually write the book?
Yeah, well, you know, so I did keep quite a bit of distance from my dad. Even once I was clean and sober, he never called me. I think, you know, probably because partly he was still smuggling, and then even when he wasn't, I think he had a lot of guilt. But I called him, I stayed in touch with him on, you know, his birthday and holidays. And I just was always fascinated, though, with his life. I mean, he was like bigger than life, charismatic. He'd be the guy in the room with everyone around him, men and women, lots of women. He was a good-looking, strapping man, just laughing at him. He was telling jokes. He was like the life of the party. I mean, you never knew who he was, but he was very entertaining. But I just really wanted to know, like, what on earth happened? How did he go from this doting, loving father, you know, to and very dedicated police officer, putting his life on the line, you know, to stop drug smuggling, to being in prison for drug smuggling, just walking away from his family without a glance back? And he just one day out of the blue called me. And something inside me, you know, talking about another turning point, something inside me said, this is your chance. If you ever going to have a chance, this is it. You know, just ask him. And I said, I mean, he said, how's life or whatever, blah, 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 the usuals. Very uncomfortable because we don't have any relationship, really. And I just took a breath and said, hey, Dad, you know, I'd love to know what happened to you. You know, what happened to us? How that all happened? And then he got really quiet and said, "What? Why? You know, you think that would be educational or interesting?" And I probably laughed and said, are you kidding? You have a life that not a lot of people have led. It would be very interesting. But mostly, I just want to know who you are and what happened. And he sounded very nervous, which I never heard my dad sound. And he said, well, what are you going to do? Come out here and interview me? And I went, yes, I'll come interview. I had no plan. Hmm. So I traipsed out there with my tape recorder and started interviewing him.
So when you talked to him, because you said a memoir of a drug smuggler's daughter, what was he willing to actually discuss? And were there things that he said, can't go that far. And by the way, is he alive? Has he passed? Your brother, what's going on with them?
Yeah. So my father is no longer living. He died in 2014. So in April, so almost 10 years ago. And I try not to talk about people who are living that are in the memoir, because memoirs are very personal and I try to protect people's privacy, but my brother is still alive. I can say that. And we're in touch. So we're in communication. So my father told me everything. And I thought it was probably half lies, because, you know, there's a thing, how do you know when an addict is lying? Their lips are moving. So I just think he was lying, you know? And I mean, but a lot of his memories were shared, because he remembered stuff that I also remembered, you know, from growing up, you know, living in the same household. But all the smuggling and the arrests he made and his arrests, I thought, well, I just don't know. I don't know. It was fascinating, though. And I recorded it all. I'm so glad I did that. And when I got back home, I thought, I'm going to see if I can get his court records. And I got them. And they were verbatim what he told me. I mean, almost exactly what he told me. And then I realized that what he said was true. Was he said, hey, hon, darling, him is called me darling. This is your legacy. That I'm sorry, there's not more good than bad, but this is your legacy. So I'm going to lay it all out on the line here. And so he told me everything. And when I, you know, corroborated all that with his court records, I found newspaper articles about arrests he had made, all kinds of stuff. And I went back. I was like compelled to write that story, and I started writing. And what came out first was sort of my story. And then I wrote his story. Actually, I kind of wrote them both together. And I went back the next summer and read it to him. He never wanted to read it. He always wanted me to read it to him, which I thought was interesting. And he said, well, I sure like those parts about my life. The parts that were my perspective were really painful for him, you know, to hear what happened to his family when he walked out on us. I think that was very painful to hear. He wasn't there. He left. So he didn't see what happened.
And that was when you decided that was a perfectly good.
No, that was Midnight Calling. So the first book I published was Midnight Calling, which was my perspective. And I don't know why I published it that way. I don't know why. And it doesn't really matter. But Midnight Calling is really my perspective of growing up with this charismatic cop of a dad and what happened to us later, and then my early recovery journey. And then Breaking Midnight, a true story, is his story. It's not you know, a transcript. I certainly made a transcript of our audio recordings, but I wrote a story, a true story about his life. And I spent many years after that going over that with him. We worked on it together. He really supported it being published, and he read a draft of it. So he did read a draft of it before he died and wanted it to be published. He really supported. He only asked that I not use his name. It was the only thing he asked. So
that's how. Yeah, let me let Yeah, let me ask you this. You spend this time with your dad. What I found when I wrote my book, it was very cathartic. It allowed me to release a lot of the pain of my mom's death. So, it happened within a year. She got stage 4 colon cancer, and it was just so unexpected. And I thought she'd live into her hundreds, like my grandmother and my great grandmother. By spending this time with your dad, what feelings did you have afterwards? How did you feel about your dad?
Yeah. It was the best gift he could have given me. And I think it's not just his story. It was the willingness to be honest. And that allowed us to heal. Like I said, I went down there every year after that, sometimes twice a year, and we talked on the phone a lot. And we didn't just talk about the story or filling in gaps that I needed in the story. It was about anything. And it gave him a chance to say in his words, that he didn't feel good. He said, I didn't feel good about what I did to you and your mom and your brother. And, I'm here now, and I got to tell him that I forgave him. And I did. And I was so grateful for that. And I don't know if we would have ever gotten to that if I hadn't said, tell me your story. And he hadn't been willing to do it. And so it was like we cleared all the air between us, the space. And it just was, wasn't full of all that resentment and pain and abandonment, so much abandonment. Mm-hmm. So when he died, I was able to just feel the grief, the sadness. I remember your podcast about your father dying right before your book launch, I felt sad that I couldn't get that book published before he passed away, but I had this whole other career. It was very consuming, and two kids came along, and I was parenting, and, it was hard. So I just couldn't get it written before he died, but he read the bulk of it.
Yeah, no, I hear you. And my dad got to hear half of it, and I too read half of the book, half of Relaunch, Spark Your Heart, to him. It just took a lot longer. I'd start reading and fall asleep, not because he was bored, but because he was starting to get sick. So now
it's so touching to me that you did that to your dad too.
I did. And it was funny. I'm like, Dad, just another couple pages. And he'd be like head nodding. He's like, oh, that's really good, Hillary. That's really good. I'm like, anyway, what I do want to ask you, the book has really resonated with people out there, and it's number one bestseller, all these incredible accolades for you. Why do you feel people are just really, they really want to hear these stories, your stories? What do you think is resonating?
Well, I think that people are just fascinated with peeking into other people's lives. I mean, memoirs are very popular. I think we so much compare our insides and how we feel, how other people look. And everybody always looks more together, right? But I think part of that is just that it's a, up close and personal. They're all very up close and personal. And I had a lot of angst about that. But that's what makes memoirs, I think, powerful, is that you don't hold back too much. But the other part is I really think that maybe almost unintentionally, these books ended up being about my brokenness. And I think that we're all broken in some way. I mean, everybody's broken in some way. And I think that this is a book of being broken and repairing a life, my life, my dad repairing his life, and trying to, move on and start over. And I think that that's a powerful message for humans, right? I think we all have that journey in some way, more or less, I think.
I agree with you. And what would you say is the story that most surprised you when your dad told this to you that you put in the book?
I was really surprised that he was a dirty cop. I always thought the smuggling, as I could piece it together, because he was no longer on the force when he got arrested. But I just always thought he was such a patriot, and I just was stunned that he actually did his first smuggling deal while he was still a cop. That was just really
what a blow, right?
Yeah. And I guess, That would have been in the mid-70s. By the mid-80s, I guess 80, 90% of the Miami-Dade police force was corrupt. I mean, they were all on the payroll of the smuggler.
Isn't that when Miami Vice started?
Probably. Yeah, I think so, right? And they were all dirty because they got paid $100,000 to just look the other way. But this was before that, you know? So I was just really surprised that he did his first deal, you know, money. And I literally found a newspaper article about that, too, how it was kind of forced to resign before, or they were going to have to investigate because they had a witness that was going to turn evidence against them.
But he was able to resign first.
Yeah, I tried to get the internal investigation records, but that's all hands off. I could never get my hands on that. So there was some kind of internal investigation, but no charges were ever brought. And he left the force. So
through your journey, what would you say is the most important message that you are leaving readers and listeners with your book?
I think that, I guess my message is always never, you know, no matter what you're struggling with, I mean, we all struggle with something, whatever it could be, anything, you know, I just think my message is don't give up, right? No matter what you're struggling with, never give up, because things can turn on a dime. Life can turn on a dime. Things can change in a moment. You never know when somebody comes into your life or some event happens that could maybe help you deal with, you know, whatever it is you're struggling with. So don't ever give up. And never, ever, no matter what, never give up on teenagers because they often do come around, right? Teenagers often come around.
They sure do.
especially when they're hurting, you know, often all they need, you know, even if it's the last thing you want to do, or when you don't believe in them, is they just need someone to believe in them, you know, even when you don't think they're going to make it, or especially when you don't think they're going to make it, you know, because I think if you'd have seen me at 15, anybody would have thought, how sad, but you know, life can turn on a dime.
So Lynn, you also said, and I love talking to authors about kind of their vice that they were doing when they were writing the book. Tell us what you turned to when you were writing your book.
What do you mean turn to?
Well, you were saying how much you love to...
Yeah. Chocolate?
Yes!
I love that!
I was doing chips. Like, I would go and I'd have these bags of these, like, chips. And my husband always knew, oh God, she's deep into it, depending on how many chips I'd gone through.
I talk about potato chips in my third book, A Perfectly Good Fantasy, because I have an addiction to potato chips. I truly do. But I
love that you just admitted that. Good. Yeah, you also said you can't really eat sugar. So you had found a chocolate. Because I was like, I couldn't do the sweets because the sweets made me kind of wiry. And then my mind, I couldn't focus. So
yeah.
What's the brand of chocolate you got?
Chocolate, remember this. I guess I should have said this. Never give up. And remember, chocolate is like a little hug. And who could not use a hug, right?
So I love that.
So yes. I don't eat sugar, but I really like this brand called Stirs the Soul. I mean, what name is that?
What a name.
Stir the Soul. And it's with dates.
I love.
Yeah.
I love dates.
The chocolate with the little cayenne in it, and they have the chocolate with the whatever cacao nibs, and they're just sweet. Like each bar has one date in it.
Oh, so good!
Have it shipped. I think they're in Oregon, not in the hot summer because it'll melt. But ship it to you. Like, Oregon cake now. Stir the Soul. Love that stuff.
Stir the Soul. We'll have a
dark chocolate too.
Dark,
yeah.
Which is actually, I'm going to say it. I'm going to call it out. I'm sure someone's going to tell me it's not true. I have heard that dark chocolate is actually good for you.
I think it is.
I know it's good for me.
It's not loaded with sugar. I mean, I don't know. Sugar probably isn't an issue for some people, but it is for me. So,
well, thank you, Lynn, for being here. This has been as good as I knew it would be. Your story, your presence, everything about you. I'm such a big admirer. So thank you.
Thank you
so much.
And thank you. I just love that how you're, you know, elevating voices like this. I love this podcast. So thank you so much.
Well, appreciate you being here. And everyone, again, Relaunch is about relaunch you, relaunch your life, relaunch the magic of what you have. And so live now, love now, relaunch now, and think about where you are right now and how so many relaunches have shaped you. And that now is the time, as Lynn is saying, we're looking at the future, and so many stories are within you that you can be sharing with family and friends that will literally be the beacon of light for so many. So just get out there, tell your story. And if you think you've got a great story that you want to also get out into the Relaunch show, please let us know. Visit our website, therelaunchco.com, and under podcast, let us know. And I would love to talk to you about your relaunch story right here on the Relaunch podcast. Anyway, we'll see you all again next week. Thanks again, Lynn.
Thanks.
All right, that's a wrap for today's episode of the Relaunch Podcast. If you felt a spark, a shift, or a little nudge from our show today, why not leave a 5-star review on iTunes? It helps us spread the word, so please share this episode with someone who could use that same spark. Make sure to check out therelaunch.com/podcast for the goodies from today's episode. And remember this, right now is your golden opportunity to shift and relaunch into the life you've always imagined. Let's continue to build our own powerful stories of resilience and reinvention. Until next time, ready, set, relaunch.